On today's podcast, we're going to do something a little bit different. Over the last week or so, I've been reading a book called Samsung Rising by Jeffrey Kane. It's an absolutely fantastic book for anyone that's been around tech the last really 20 years. A great story about the rise of Samsung, how they got into the semiconductor business, all sorts of intrigue. He covers off on the repeated court cases, not just between Samsung and Apple, but Samsung's executives and the government of South Korea over all the bribes and scandals. Really great book. Anyway, Jeffrey and I spent about 45 minutes together, and the interview was so great and lengthy and detailed that we wanted to put this out as a standalone piece. So check this out. Really, really great. He's a smart young guy that's documented this story in great detail. You learn all about how they got started in the SSD business and the NAND business by borrowing, using heavy air quotes, technology from Micron to get there. Anyway, I want to bring Jeffrey in for this spot, but it's really great. Hope you enjoy. Joining us on the podcast today, we've got Jeffrey Kane, author of Samsung Rising. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, bro.
Yeah, it's a great book. I've read it cover to cover. A lot of this happened as I've been involved in technology. But before we dive too much into the book about Samsung, how is it that you got to this point in your career anyway? Surely when you were a young boy riding your bicycle, you weren't thinking about writing a story about Samsung. What was the career build up to writing this book?
That's a funny point. So I do have to say that when I was young, I was always drawn to narrative storylines, and I actually drew my own comic books and I drew my own picture books before I could read. That was just a fun way of kind of creating my own stories. And, of course, these were fiction. These were like superhero stories and Marvel comic stories, like a lot of, young boys enjoy. But this book was the fruition of about 10 years of research and reporting. I was a correspondent in East Asia. I was in South Korea for a long time, China, Southeast Asia, a bit of the Middle East. And while I was there, I got a call from my editor. I was working for the Fast Company, which is a technology magazine in New York. And they said that they needed someone who could be in Korea to do an article on Samsung, which was at the time, this was 2010, kind of a company that was more in the background of the technology world that, people knew about but hadn't really learned about in terms of who are these people, who are the people who make these products and make these semiconductors. I mean, everybody was ordering components from them. I think that, in the tech industry, pretty much everybody has to go through Samsung or some other big Asian manufacturer at some point to get the parts they need. And, I went on this trip and we were invited out to the headquarters. It was a 2-day trip. We toured the offices, looked at some of the new smartphone designs they were getting ready for, talked about the future of technology. And, this was 10 years ago and they were already talking about foldable handsets that are just, the ones that are just coming out now. I thought it was a fascinating trip because I didn't realize just how large Samsung was in the technology world, but then so many people just don't really know the story of who they are. Everywhere I would go, I would see the Samsung advertisements everywhere, and there was the Galaxy phone, and Apple was suing Samsung at the time for patent infringement. And, a lot of my friends, they had Samsung phones, and everybody was just kind of like, what is this company that's competing with Apple and also making the components for Apple and other firms? So, I thought that it would be kind of fascinating. I thought it would be very fascinating to set out to tell the story of this major technology empire that makes just about everything. It has more than 50 affiliates, employs more than 300,000 people, makes up 1/5 of South Korea's exports, and also has a chairman who has been in and out of trials for tax evasion, bribery, and actually was sentenced to prison twice.
Right.
Both times presidential pardons. He never served a day in prison, which speaks to the power and influence of Samsung in South Korea. So South Koreans call their country the Republic of Samsung. And that's what I found just so fascinating about this company that it looms large everywhere, and yet it's so hidden and so behind the scenes in technology.
Well, I gosh, there's so much there I want to dive into. One of the things I think is interesting, and we even struggle with, you know, with as Storage Review, is which Samsung are we talking to? And I know that sounds that would sound ridiculous to almost anybody, but you know, a lot of times it's Samsung Semiconductor, but some of the packaged goods are different divisions. And you said there are 50 or something like that. All of the companies that are intertwined, and that's sort of fundamental to some of the nuance and some of the problems ultimately with Samsung that we can get into. But just break that down a little bit. When we say Samsung, it's not like Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati. It's a bunch of different companies that are, I don't know if there's a better word than somewhat incestuous to describe them, but they're really you know, overlapping in a lot of ways.
Yes, so people often call Samsung a conglomerate, and they say it's the world's largest technology conglomerate. That is actually incorrect. Samsung is not a conglomerate. It's a collection of companies that are loosely connected to each other through these cross-shareholding structures. So it's this giant web of companies that is under the control of a founding family, and this is the family of Lee Kun-hee, who is the current chairman of Samsung. So you know, like I actually hear this from a lot of people who are doing business with Samsung. Maybe they're, you know, they have a supplier relationship, they have a contract, and they say exactly what you just said, that we're not totally sure which Samsung we're talking to, because one day we have to deal with Samsung SDI, which makes batteries, and then the next day we're dealing with you know, Samsung Display, and you know, we're putting in an order for LED displays or LCDs. And they can never figure out, well, wait a second, you know, this is one company, right? But it seems like these are different entities that, you know, like I can't contact Display and say like, hey, can you talk to SDI and see if they got that battery order in for us? Like it's like you have to go through each company to get each thing done. And the reason for that is because they are actually separate companies on paper. They don't report to a holding company that owns all of them or some kind of, you know, overarching structure. The only structure they have is that the chairman and his family own stakes in Chael, which is the top company in this shareholding web. And then Chael, which means best in Korean, it owns pieces of, you know, like it used to own Samsung C&T, and then, you know, Samsung C&T will own part of Samsung Life Insurance, and then Samsung Life Insurance will own part of Samsung Electronics. And it just goes in this giant circle between these, you know, the publicly traded companies in this web. And then it ultimately reports back to the Samsung chairman and his son. And it makes the way that they make decisions is that the boards will get together from each company and they'll vote on, you know, company shareholding matters. So like, should we merge this one? Should we make this device? Should we move into this industry? And the way they keep control is that not only do they, you know, own a stake that allows them to keep control, but the boards of each company effectively make decisions that work for the Samsung ruling family and not necessarily the Samsung shareholders. I mean, the outside board members are supposed to be a check sure. against them, and they're actually voting, you know, in favor overwhelmingly for the family. That's how they keep control.
It's just amazing, because I think back to you know, when I was a kid or even a student in the 80s and 90s, there was a period of time where in the U.S. there was a lot of reverence for Japan, where if it was Honda or Toyota, like Toyota cars for a long period of time were thought to be better than any other car that America could make. And, you know, Michael Keaton movie, Gung Ho, right? Where they had to deal with the Asian company coming in and asserting policies and all these things that were different or difficult for Americans to handle. And this, the description you've made of Samsung in their sort of, gosh, it's like a family dictatorship almost, that is so foreign to American culture, that caused a lot of problems, probably still does throughout Samsung, that's just so challenging. But I know when you go back into the early days of Samsung, they had some of that same reverence for the Japanese culture and companies too. But it doesn't seem like you tell me, how much of that did they really ingrain into their organization?
So yes, actually, you are right about Japan and Korea. The reality is that the Korean economy and its heavy industry and technology sectors are built on some of the ideas that the Japanese had promulgated for a long time. This idea of the corporation being a representative of the nation and building the nation through its products. You know, the idea of a ruling family that oversees a giant conglomerate that makes everything. And these are conglomerates, especially during World War II, Japanese conglomerates, which were called zaibatsu, were the largest corporations in the world. You know, I think that as Americans, we tend to think of Ford and GE and, you know, these classic success stories, Thomas Edison. We don't realize that if you look over to Asia and Japan in particular, so just one company, Mitsui, was the largest corporation in the world at that time and employed 1 million people who were not Asian. And you know, I'm only talking about people who were not Asian, and there are infinitely more people. Just you know, this company itself was an army. I mean, it was a military that could execute commands at fast order, you know, and could build the nation and could help the Japanese war effort. And these ideas were adopted by Korea too. So Korea became an independent nation, South Korea, in 1948, and this was when the Republic of Korea was founded, and then, you know, the Korea was split into two, and after that the Korean War started. But the idea of the leaders of Korea throughout their history was that you know, a lot of them have been trained in Japan. Some of them had served in the Japanese military during World War II. Japan was a colonizer of Korea. You know, they had seen, you know, some of the strengths and weaknesses of that Japanese system, and they were trying to find ways to adopt what they knew from their Japanese experience to Korea, because they had seen that, you know, even though Japan had been a colonizer, they saw how enormously successful Japan was, you know, both before World War II and after World War II, at becoming this, you know, respected power on the global stage. They wanted something similar for Korea. And that's really what led to the birth of Samsung and also Hyundai, LG, SK. You know, these are common names that we see on our smartphones and cars in America. These companies were birthed by this idea to build the Korean nation to make it great.
That's interesting. And you talked about some of the other names. You know, I think at this point everyone in America is aware of Samsung, but we spend a lot of time with SK Hynix now, too, one of the leading DRAM manufacturers in the world. They've recently expanded into flash storage, and they're gaining quite a bit of traction in the US. Has South Korea, how are they doing on diversification to get away from the risk that is having such a giant company like Samsung generating as much of that GDP as you initially indicated?
So they actually are not doing so great. I was more optimistic about this before, but there was a new president who was put into office. So just to for listeners who I don't I'm sure most listeners don't follow, you know, Korean politics every
No,
day,
I would assume
yeah,
not.
just to, just to go back a little bit. So Samsung and the South Korean president were embroiled in a major corruption scandal in which Samsung executives were caught buying racehorses worth $1 million each as bribes for a crony of the president, who turned out to be the daughter of a prominent cult leader. And this crony of the president had somehow managed to take over, you know, the president's schedule, and, you know, was able to look at her speeches before they were released. And it was basically this person behind the throne who was controlling a lot of what the South Korean president did. So a number of Samsung executives were arrested, put on trial, found guilty of corruption and embezzlement, and then the South Korean president was impeached and imprisoned for 33 years, you know, for this bribery scandal. So it was a scandal that brought down a good deal of the South Korean elite, and it spoke to the power of these Korean chaebol, that's what they're called, these conglomerates in Korea. So the current president has been trying to reform them and, you know, break them apart and lessen their power over the economy. But the fact is that they're simply too powerful. They're too big to fail. And he hasn't had much luck doing that so far, which is quite sad. But, you know, it's actually something that America went through too at some point. I mean, you know, in the late 19th century, we had similar giant conglomerates that were called trusts, and they were these interlocking monopolies created
Sure.
by people like Andrew Carnegie. America was not always, the capitalist country it was today. It was more like an oligarchy back then, and it was Theodore Roosevelt who really spearheaded the effort to break them up and to, you know, turn them into more manageable businesses that were competitive, and, you know, that would help the nation, and it would help, you know, make prices more competitive for consumers. It would, you know, it would get them a bit more under control, so they're not challenging, you know, the power of the federal government, for example. I mean, he didn't want to have a nation that was built on these giant conglomerates that could call the shots on everything. So yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we went through. And now, you know, we built a system where we do have, you know, big corporations. I think that it's very trendy right now for people to knock on Amazon and, you know, Jeff Bezos. But if you look at the American economy as a whole, we have, you know, lots of SMEs, you know, very healthy SME sectors and, you know, component suppliers. You're talking about storage right now. I mean, it's we do have a very diversified economy that South Korea has not really struggled to make. I was actually just speaking to somebody yesterday in the manufacturing industry, and he pointed out the fact that, you know, we talk about the rise of China and Korea, but the countries that are still the best manufacturers in the world and the most profitable manufacturers are America, Japan, and Germany, because our economies are so diversified and we can do so much. So, you know, I just think that it's kind of a tragedy that Korea hasn't really been able to get ahead of that system.
Well, you talk about the trials and the imprisonments, but the Samsung guys, even though they spent some time, it wasn't the 5 years that was initially allocated in that sentence, though, right? So it's still a situation where there's preference for that, for the Samsung ruling family.
Yes, exactly. So the Samsung leaders, so Jay Lee, who is the heir to the Samsung empire, was put on trial and sentenced to 5 years in prison. This was a big deal because, first of all, that level of sentence for a leader at a chaebol group in Korea was unprecedented for corruption. These corruption trials are fairly common. Just about every big chaebol leader is a convicted criminal. They've been convicted of bribery or embezzlement or tax evasion at some point. And in this case, you know, he got more than the usual 2 years in prison. They usually get like 2-3 years in prison, and then it's commuted, and then the president gives them a pardon. But 5 years meant, second of all, that the judge could actually not commute it, that he would actually have to go to prison and be in solitary confinement in a cell. And you have to, you know, you have to think about this. I mean, think about the significance of this. I mean, could you imagine if, you know, Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or, you know, Jeff Bezos, you know, were sentenced to 5 years in prison for bribing, you know, Donald Trump, you know, something right, totally just off the rails. But then what happened in Korea is that he had an appeals trial, and the appeals court decided to uphold part of his bribery charge, while at the same time reducing the sentence and then letting him out on a commuted sentence. So that meant that he was still a convicted criminal for bribing the president, but he was free to go, essentially. He was free to go back and lead Samsung. He was still the vice chairman of Samsung. He was still on the board of directors for a while. And, you know, that's what's just so interesting about these Korean companies, is that I just can't imagine an equivalent in many other places at all. I mean, could you imagine Steve Jobs getting a pardon, and then, you know, he's let out in the middle of his sentence.
Like nothing happened.
It's just like, and then he's running Apple again. It's just, it's truly bizarre.
No, it's really remarkable. But so here's the thing that's even weirder to me. So you talk about corruption at that level, and you gave a great example of trust busting in the U.S. But the fact that the population of South Korea doesn't stand up and say this is horseshit, you know, like, what are we doing here, is really remarkable. And I know there are some that do, but there's a substantial part of the population that I don't want to say is, you know, well, they're definitely drinking the Kool-Aid, right? And saying, oh, we, yeah, need Samsung to be successful or we're all going to suffer. I mean, that's an amazing dichotomy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there are a lot of people, a substantial portion of the population, that is, as you say, drinking the Kool-Aid. There are people who oppose these chaebol groups, and they're in favor of antitrust. They want to break them up. But it really is just, you know, I just find it so incredible that Samsung and Hyundai and these other companies have managed to convince so much of the population that their health and well-being of these companies is indicative of the health and well-being of Korea as a nation, Korea's standing in the world. And if Samsung fails, then Korea will fail. People really do buy into that, especially the older generation of Koreans. So I actually gave an interview a couple of weeks ago to the biggest Korean newspaper, which is called the Chosun newspaper. And, you know, this is like, it's like the equivalent. I mean, it would be sort of like a, you know, maybe Wall Street Journal or New York Post or Fox News. Like, sure. It has that kind of, you know, that kind of style of reporting to it. And they published the interview, got it translated, and I was reading the comments. So I thought that, you know, some of this would be controversial among their readers. Like, why is this business, you know, acting so in such a corrupt way? And the comments were more along the lines of, you know, like, Samsung is a part of my country. Samsung is my country, and I'm proud of Samsung. And, you know, people said, like, I'm proud to be a shareholder in Samsung. I stand up for Samsung, and I believe that Samsung has made Korea great. I mean, this was the overwhelming response to this That's interview amazing. With me that, you know, showed both the good and bad. I mean, not a single person I could see highlighted that dark side and that, you know, that corrupt side to it.
That's crazy. So, yeah, I know you wrote about Samsung, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but is this common throughout the other big companies, big tech companies specifically in South Korea?
Yes, it is. It is. It's very common. So you mentioned SK Hynix before.
Right.
So SK, so I believe I'd have to go back and check, but Hynix was actually spun off from LG a long time ago. It was a government transaction. The government was trying to break apart these conglomerates and specialize them a little more after a financial crisis that happened in the late 1990s. And so Hynix, through this deal, became a part of SK. And the idea was that they were going to focus, you know, more on storage, as you talked about, and semiconductors. And yeah, they have been doing very well. But the leader of SK, a man named Choi Tae-won, he's also been sentenced to two prison terms. And he was actually serving prison time. He was in a jail cell, and then the South Korean president a few years ago pardoned him. And then right after he got out of jail, he made an announcement to the Korean media and said that he was also, on top of this, he was fathering a secret child, you know, outside of his marriage. He came clean with all this dirt about his life. And it was almost like the reaction in Korea was, you know, there was some public discontent, and people were, you know, slinging mud at him and saying, come on, you're a convicted criminal. You have the secret child, like, get your life together, please, you know, be a role model for our country. But then right after that, you know, it only took a little bit of time before people started saying, like, well, actually, this is just normal. You know, this kind of thing is normal in Korea, and it's just what we expect from these business leaders. And, you know, like, they build Korea, they represent the country, so we just have to kind of go along with this in and out of prison thing, you know, with these presidential pardons. You know, and SK is not just the only example. I could give you all kinds of examples. Hyundai had a major succession fight about 15 years ago that led to all kinds of dirt and corruption and all these things being exposed out in public, you know, investigations. I don't know if you've seen the HBO show Succession, but I think that the story of these cable groups is very closely goes along with that story of, you know, Succession, about this father who runs this media conglomerate, and he has a stroke, and he has to prepare the succession for his son, but people don't really like the son, and then there's this dynastic battle, and there's a shareholder fight, and, you know, it's lots of plotting and backstabbing. That really is the story of Samsung and Hyundai and SK and all these firms. It's a family soap opera behind the glossy technological, you know, front that we usually see here in America.
It's crazy. It's like a modern day version of the Tudors or something, where there are all these children too. So, like, if it was just one kid and the kid wasn't that bright, then maybe they'd have to come up with Plan B. But it's really crazy. So it was interesting for me thinking about international relations. You as an American, writing a story about a family that wasn't going to be glossy and shiny like they would typically communicate. Did you ever worry about yourself or your safety when you were over there?
I actually did not worry, but people told me in Korea that I should watch my back. So I actually sat down for a nice long interview with a doctor who had been involved with Samsung a long time ago. He's a prominent doctor in Korea. He didn't want his name revealed, but he gave the interview kind of on background. I could use some of the material. And, you know, he told me about what it was like going in and meeting the Samsung chairman, and, you know, what like what it was like going to these award ceremonies that Samsung was holding. He gave lectures to Samsung executives, you know, on public health and all this. And as he was talking, so he was in his office, and then he called in the nurse or the assistant and, you know, said, like, can you please just check this place for bugs? And I thought he was joking. I mean, I cracked up and I was like, what? And he said, no, you don't understand. Like, we're dealing with Samsung here. They might have bugged my room if they think that you're, you know, coming in to do this interview. And I thought it was like a kooky conspiracy of some kind.
Right.
Yeah, and then he turned up the music really loud, you know, while he was talking. And he said, let's just turn this up just in case. I'm not sure if my computer is hacked. This was just one example. I left that interview thinking, like, you know, well, you know, I'm sure Samsung didn't bug the room. But, you know, this is a very respected medical professional in Korea who, you know, he's on the news a lot. And I think that this speaks to the fear that Samsung strikes in, you know, a lot of Koreans. They really do fear this company as much as they admire it. They see them as powerful. And, you know, they're the type of people who, if they wanted to ruin your career, they could go after you. And actually, that did happen. A few whistleblowers did have their careers ruined. And, you know, it wasn't just this doctor, but I would go around and interview people. I interviewed somebody in the display industry once, and he had just flown back from Silicon Valley making these fancy deals with big, you know, Apple type companies. And he said, like, look, he said, I've heard rumors that Samsung, you know, if they don't like you occasionally, they just knock people off. They might stage a car crash. So you just be careful, you know, just like keep an eye behind your shoulder. You know, if there's a car coming at you, make sure you get out of the way. They're going to make it look like, you know, something bad happened, like something bad happened. Sure. There was an accident, but it's really going to be Samsung. Trust me.
Well, that it's not so difficult to believe. And we've seen that at least with political dissidents in many other places. I mean, if you were writing the same book about Huawei in China, would you feel different? I think I would, about the potential of being disappeared or accidental death or something along those lines.
Yes, and actually that did happen. So I was actually, something similar happened. I was detained in China briefly, in Western China, a couple of years ago. I was looking into some of these technology firms, and this is a region that's highly surveilled. I mean, there are just millions of cameras out there, and they're using an artificial intelligence system to monitor people and to document them and to figure out what they're all about. They do this thing called pre-crime, where the AI will try to predict whether you're going to become a criminal. I mean, it's truly out of a sci-fi novel. But there was a group of police who I had taken a photo, and they very quickly surrounded me and told me to come.
They don't care for that, do they?
Oh, yeah. No, they don't care for photos. They want you to take photos that'll make China look good. But, you know, once you take a photo of something that's a little sensitive, you better watch out. You're going to spend the next 3 hours in a Chinese police station. So, you know, they looked up, they took my phone, and then they gave it back to me, and they made me load up my photos, and they made me scroll through each one, and they told me which ones I could delete and which ones I could keep.
Oh my gosh.
This is because I'm looking at Chinese technology, and, you know, looking at Huawei and Xiaomi. You do actually have to be worried about what these companies are doing. I mean, China is, in my opinion, it's becoming a bad actor in the technology world. And I think that a lot of people have known that there's a Chinese threat for a while, but it hasn't really caught on at the political level where the government's recognizing it and launching these trade wars for a long time. So I was actually, when the lawsuits against Huawei started, so, you know, Huawei, which was becoming a big supplier for American firms of hardware and also buying American hardware, kind of a tit for tat going back both ways. I was looking through the Huawei, the court proceedings and the court documents from the prosecutor against Huawei. And they talked about how Huawei, they had an employee actually go to, I think it was Sprint or AT&T, one of those carriers. They had a robot called Tappy that was able to tap really fast on, you know, on phones, and it could test, you know, the durability and the responsiveness of a phone display and the software. And it was just a really good device for the quality control. And they actually had somebody break in and steal the arm of the Tappy, like actually rip it off, even with all these cameras there and everywhere. And he managed to steal it, and then he managed to get out before, you know, and then the security found out about it. And so this company launched a lawsuit against Huawei. They tried to keep it quiet for a little while because it was really embarrassing. But anyway, I was just looking at that. I was thinking, like, seriously, I mean, you hear stories about IP theft, but I've never heard a story of essentially a Chinese corporate spy breaking into, you know, the main American, you know, quality control center for a major carrier, stealing its robot, attempting to take it out, and then, yeah, and then like trying to remake it for Huawei. That shows the extent of the Chinese threat. And, you know, if I were an executive in, you know, in the technology, I mean, in storage and displays, in any kind of component industry that relies on Chinese hardware, I would be doing everything I can right now to try to get, you know, like just try to lessen those relationships, because it is a threat. And China is also enforcing forced IP transfers now. So if you want to enter a joint venture or partner with a Chinese company, under Chinese law, you're required to transfer your IP to that company. So, you know, it's open theft at this point. I think that the future of China is not going to be good. And I think that, you know, it is, you know, a threat for the average American businessman.
Well, it's interesting. In the last revisions of servers, when Intel put out new CPUs and then AMD has come out with a second set of server CPUs, there's been a lot of conversation from the server vendors about where their boards come from. Because there was another issue where there was some rogue hardware installed on a server board that came out of China, allegedly. So, you know, You're right, I think, in that businesses need to be concerned about where the source is for the equipment they're buying as part of, you know, a trust issue more than reliability or cost at this point. Yeah, really interesting. So getting back to Samsung, I want to talk about Samsung Semi a little bit. I know the thrust of your book is around phone innovation and competition with Apple, which is really great. And we can talk about that some more as well. But Samsung Semi, at least from our standpoint, is one of the guys we deal with quite a bit. And you had just one little note, I think it was around 50 or 60 pages in, about a bizarre relationship with Micron. Can you expand on that or tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So this was back when Samsung Semi, was just getting started. So this was back at the height of, in the 1980s, there were the America-Japanese wars. It was Intel and Fairchild and, you know, Micron, more of an upstart, versus, like Hibachi or Toshiba, you know, these Japanese, you know, semiconductor and storage giants. And Samsung was this third mover. So Samsung was coming in. They opened their first fab plant in 1983. They basically went in not knowing what they were doing. They had no IP, no expertise. They relied on Japanese engineers to come in and moonlight and show them how to do things and give them IP and things like that. And one of the things that Samsung Semi did is they set up an office in California that was supposed to act as a radar system, looking out for, you know, new technologies on the horizon, or trying to, you know, gather intel on what other companies were doing. And at certain points in this office's history, it started spilling over into outright just IP theft. You know, it was like there's that fine line in the technology world between, like, you know, you're listening to rumors and trying to, you know, reverse engineer things and just figuring out what your competitors are doing, versus, you know, just going into their office and just lifting whatever you can. And so Micron, which was struggling financially at this time, I think that Micron was still a startup. I believe they were founded in the late 70s or early 80s, but maybe you know more about that than me. So Samsung managed to convince Micron to give them a training course and a limited IP transfer in exchange for these payments, because Samsung was a big company outside of semiconductors. They did have a lot of money. And that deal was sort of one of the bases on which Samsung was able to build its semiconductor knowledge. So the California office engineered this operation. They were going to go in, they were going to do these trainings and look at the the supply chains and just figure out how Micron, does what it does. And so Micron told these Samsung engineers, look, you can't, you can't go into certain rooms. You can't look at certain things. Like, we're going to put black tape over sensitive objects. You're not allowed to touch any computers. Like, we're just going to bring you through, show you the office, give you a training. And that's that. But, limited IP, you can get some very basic. I mean, we're talking like 64K DRAM back in the day. Sure. Like, that's the limited IP that they would give a company like Samsung, which was pretty useless by this point. So so these engineers went in, and the operation was that they would just look around for every hint of a semiconductor diagram of, like any kind of, IP that was sitting around somewhere, maybe a paper on a desk. And you have to keep in mind that Micron's being really careful about this. But, there were these really advanced, these super complicated semiconductor, diagrams, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of these, just, how incredibly complicated they are. And they would just kind of go around and glance at them and look at them. And then they just tried to memorize as much as they could just right there. And then they would go back to the hotel and they would try to piece together those diagrams at night and just try to get as close as they could to figure out what Micron was doing. So that's just an example of, the hustle that Samsung was at this time. This relationship was truly bizarre. And then even later on, I talked to executives who were involved in this, and the way that they justified it is that they said that they said that Micron was our teacher. Micron was our teacher, and they taught us how to be a semiconductor maker. And then I would ask them about this operation, and they would say, like, yeah, of course we did that. That was the operation. We went in there, we tried to learn from what they were doing, and then we tried to memorize it, and then we just brought it back, and we tried to do that ourselves.
Yeah, I don't think hustle is how they would describe it on the Micron side. I mean, if you tried to pull something like that today, that's falls pretty squarely in corporate espionage, and you'd be facing all sorts of problems, at least in the U.S. anyway, right?
Oh, yeah. You'd probably end up in jail. That would be corporate espionage. There are trade secret laws that protect, these technologies, IP laws. I mean, that would be squarely in just IP theft, I think. I'm not a lawyer, but
sure.
I would somebody going to jail for that.
You know, it's funny because you talk a lot in the book about design and innovation and more around the Galaxy, the phone products. And I wonder about how that rubs off, or if it was a similar analog in divisions like semiconductor, where they were making a lot of mass production parts, but not necessarily taking the technology to the next level. And you did talk about that, how they caught up in the DRAM and they pretty quickly got to the point, even for the first iPhone, where their NAND was good enough to meet Apple's needs in, what was that, 2004, 5, somewhere in there, which is pretty remarkable to start from almost nothing and get to the point where you're supplying the iPhone with NAND. But at the same time, they get involved in a price-fixing scheme. I mean, it's just like, the whole story is just so bizarre. It's like that athlete that could be the best in the world at whatever, basketball, baseball, football, but always finds a way to stumble and have self-inflicted wounds. It's just so bizarre. What do you make of that whole deal with the early iPhones?
Oh yeah, I agree completely. It is it is a story of an athlete. It's like Lance, the bicycle rider.
Armstrong, who, right.
Lance Armstrong. Yeah, it's just. Samsung, and this is one of the big puzzles as I was writing this. I was trying to reconcile these two sides of, Samsung is a massive company, well-resourced, has government backing, has so much expertise that it imports from around the world, and also Korean expertise. I mean, Koreans, they are excellent engineers. They have great engineering programs, universities there. People go from, India, even America sometimes, to study engineering at places like KAIST or Seoul National University. And I just kept asking myself, why does this company keep stumbling? Why does it keep, it sees an iPhone coming. And at first they were dismissive of the iPhone and dismissive of even some of the advances in storage at that point, that were happening across the line. And then suddenly it's like they're reacting to it. Suddenly they realize, oh shoot, there's an iPhone. You know, oh shoot, there's a new product that's taking us on. So now we have to catch up really quickly and slap something together that's not even that good at the beginning, and, you know, just try to convince people that we're the alternative. It's just something that happens over and over and over in Samsung's history. And I think that, you know, business experts, so, you know, MBA students and MBA professors talk about these problems a lot, but there's a problem called the conglomerate discount. And it's this idea that, you know, the conglomerate is naturally going to be a giant bureaucracy that suffocates communications, that there's communications coming in and there is information that's coming in. But it's not the job of a conglomerate to really take in and absorb that information about what's happening in the world and what's happening in industry. The job of a conglomerate is to follow the policies of, you know, the bureaucracy, to implement the rules. And a lot of Samsung employees, in my opinion, are really no more than bureaucrats whose job is to, you know, execute and implement some kind of company policy somewhere. So there's a lot of torpor, a lot of sleepiness. It's very hard to see what's coming. Even if people know what's coming, they don't really have an empowered system where they can communicate it up to their bosses. It's going to get cut down at some point by a middle manager somewhere. So, you know, I think that the problem is that, you know, Samsung, they have the talent. You know, they have the people they need. They have the human resources, but they don't have the systems in place. The system tends to reward loyalty to a boss or loyalty to a current product rather than, you know, the vision to create a future product. And the vision is actually supposed to come from the founding family under this Chable model. It's that the system is that the founding family sets the vision. They're like a chief visionary officer. That's what I like to call them. And then the CEO downwards, they're more like the COOs. They're more like the operating officers or the executives. And their job is simply to implement the vision of the chairman. And then the problem with that is that, you know, if you have a founding family that's not that visionary, if they're not paying attention and they're sitting around not listening to what's happening in the industry, then the company is just going to be stuck. It's going to stop moving forward. It's just going to kind of sit there and just hope that, you know, the what's worked in the past is just going to keep working in the future.
Yeah, and I think we're in, from the storage perspective, we might be seeing some of that. I mean, I know in the book you detailed the phone development and some of those stumbles from the opening where, you know, just south of us where we had the flight in, what was it, Louisville, I think, where the guy had his phone igniting in his pocket, which started the thing where for the next 2 years or whatever, we would all be warned before getting on the plane that we can't have a Samsung phone, which is, I think they call that negative press. And that's not good. And then they came out with the subsequent phone was great. Then they did the foldable, which kind of sucked initially. And now maybe it's okay, but it's still $2,000. I mean, it's really a computer more than a phone. The analog on the storage side is that for a long time, Samsung drives were the best, even enterprise drives and the consumer drives, fantastic. And now in the last 2 years, really, Intel's innovated a bunch around this Optane memory, sort of a next generation NAND technology, if you will. And now they've got the fastest thing. And Toshiba, now Kioxia's, you know, catching up. And now they've got a fast thing. And Hynix is fast. And it feels like the world with Samsung tends to catch up around them. And then maybe they innovate their way out of it. I'm hoping to see that cycle selfishly because, you know, for us, seeing new products and new things happening is really great. I'm just not sure what's going to happen and if they can or will continue to innovate out or just settle into more of a mainstream volume player like Micron has done more or less.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that's what's happening in a lot of industries, and it's not just storage. So you're mentioning, you know, some of the innovations that are happening with Intel and Toshiba, and you know, I think that Samsung might have made some errors about 10 years ago that led to this situation. So in the year 2010, they released a new vision. It was called Vision 2020, and they were going to look at these new growth areas. And I think that they failed to foresee some of the storage innovations that were on the horizon that were going to change some of how the industry does things. And instead, they decided to focus on other areas. So one of them was EV batteries. They made a big bet on these electric vehicles with Tesla, and they thought, why don't we make the batteries for them? I mean, and that worked for them with cell phones. They were a leader in lithium ion batteries, and you know, they were supplying cell phones all over the world for a long time. But I think that they failed to realize that, you know, just because cell phones are booming and you can supply the, you know, the batteries for every cell phone around the world, that doesn't mean that everybody is going to embrace a Tesla car or some kind of electric vehicle, and you can just put a battery in there that's gonna work. I think they might have overestimated the consumer demand. They also tried to get into medical equipment, biologics. So they were doing biosimilar drugs, and that was a field where they wanted to innovate at first, but then they made this conscious decision to focus on the biosimilars, which basically means that they're imitating other drugs and making generic, you know, pharmaceuticals that aren't really gonna, you know, lead the market in any way. So, you know, I think that they've made this error where they've assumed that, you know, what happened in the past is going to happen in the future. And then they've also made the error of, we don't necessarily have to lead at the forefront, but we need to focus more on, you know, keeping our costs down and keeping the volume up, because volume is what's going to, you know, continue to make us a big company around the world. Volume is what puts, you know, our products in front of everybody. It's not, you know, having the premium product that's at the leading edge that's more expensive. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's not how things work anymore for a company like Samsung. They've already been through that phase where they were imitating others and where they were trying to make it cheaper and faster. But once you reach that point where you're a leading company and say in consumer electronics, you know, you're the only company that's head to head with Apple and all others have fallen by the wayside, it's just not very visionary thinking to then say, oh, well, you know, now that we're done with this, let's fall back on the follower model. And I think that's happening in storage too. But I think that if the Samsung pattern holds up, I think it's very likely that in a couple of years they will have caught up with a lot of these firms and overtaken them again.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, we've just seen some bizarre activity over the years, and it's like I said, the drives, the SSDs were fantastic. And then we would hear from like a portable hard drive guy that was a Samsung branded product. And they said, this guy told me, well, when we were doing the briefing on the product, he said, what we've really done is tried to look at what the TV group is doing for Samsung and mimic that design. And I said, oh, are you working with them? No, it's a different company. We don't have any connection with them whatsoever. We just look at their design and try to copy it in the hard drive. And I'm like, what? Like, this is so bizarre. It's got the same Samsung logo on it. How can you not be communicating? And then just a couple years ago, one of the guys we dealt with on enterprise SSDs regularly was now selling vacuums for Samsung. And just bizarre relationship things that I think get in the way. And then, you know, you noted a lot of the issues around empowering the US marketing and sales groups to really do anything without a ton of suspicion layered on top. I mean, they're just those types of management decisions don't typically generate creativity and you know, long-term success, at least not here.
No, Samsung is a top-down company. And the top-down system really only works if you have a leader who has really good vision, you know, compelling, charismatic. But if it's a headless company, you know, it's going to be like an octopus thrashing about, all the limbs everywhere. And I think one of the big problems in Samsung's leadership is that they haven't really had leadership over the past few years. Their leaders have been investigated, arrested. I mean, they've had serious corporate governance problems at the top. And I think that all trickles down to what's happening in the individual business units. So you mentioned the copying of the TV, you know, the TV storage. So like Samsung units, they will not communicate with each other unless the top office, so the chairman's office or his secretariat, steps in and says, you need to work together or you need to do something together. It's a more competitive environment where each affiliate is trying to one up each other constantly. And, you know, trying to show that, you know, we have the fastest semiconductor, we have the, you know, the best AI chip that's coming out soon.
Right.
But they don't really have much of an incentive to actually work together unless, you know, the leader says work together.
Yeah, I mean, just going through the book the whole time, you wrote this in a really nice, neutral storytelling sort of way, sort of laying out the history and then a lot of these decisions over time. And it felt like to me reading it that you both admired Samsung at times and then felt sad for them for them at sometimes. It's like going back to that athlete analogy, it's like, gosh, if you could just get off the crack, you'd be really good at basketball all the time, not just sometimes. Where'd you come out? I mean, I know it's, authors don't always want to take a position on things like that, but where do you come out at the end? Like what's your final feeling as you continue to observe Samsung now over all these years?
My final feeling. I actually had a lot of really conflicting feelings, and I had to think about this for a long time because I think that Samsung is, objectively speaking, one of the most successful companies ever. I don't think you can find many companies of its size and its profitability, and its sprawling nature, its vertically integrated nature that can hold together in the way that it has. I mean, I think it is incredible that they've managed to become a symbol of their own nation of Korea and then go around the world and, going from this third-rate microwave maker process to actually competing with the biggest companies in the world, including Japan, which, was in the 1980s and still in many ways a world leader in so many different technologies that are coming out. I think that it's hard to find examples of companies that have gone from that zero to hero story. Like usually, it's that either you're going to be Apple, and Apple started out as the premium maker and they were always at that high end, and it didn't work out for them at the beginning, but eventually they were able to put products in the hands of consumers and it started catching on from the top. I don't think that bottom to top story is as common. Like you have to start out at the top if you want to be at the top in I think a lot of modern business history as we've seen. But at the same time, I mean, I'm still always just kind of perplexed and also a bit giggly. I'm always laughing at the leadership cult at Samsung. I just think it's so funny that, and funny is the only word I can think of, that, a company can be this successful and they're still worshiping their founding family as if they're these dynastic gods, like some kind of Greek god, and it's like, here he is passing the heavens to his son. And they're writing these scriptures that are handed down to the employees in the field, and they must read the dictates of the chairman and memorize his sayings, and then we're gonna all talk about it, watch a video of the chairman, and reflect on your morality. This is how Samsung traditionally talked to its employees, and I think that it tells a story of what it means to truly inspire a nation and inspire all these hundreds of thousands of employees. To convince them that they're a part of something great and historic and something that they feel proud of. There was a famous saying by Napoleon that people don't go out there and risk their lives on the battlefield for this little piece of ribbon you're going to put on them. They go risk their lives because you have to electrify their soul. And I think Samsung did a really good job of doing that, of tying their goals to the success of this one country. Whereas a lot of companies, they focus on the balance sheets and the quarterly earnings and, the shareholder calls. And I think that's really where things are different for them. So, I do have this admiration of what they've done, but I also have this criticism of the fact that they can do this, while getting away with all these, terrible white collar crimes and corruption and defrauding the pension service of Korea. It really is propagandistic, and it's just like, yeah, you've done a great job, but your leadership, like once you lift that veil, your leadership is just terrible. Like this is, I would never want to work for somebody who is, defrauding the, Social Security in America and, like that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a very mixed legacy for me, but that's why I wrote the book in a balanced way. I wanted to show that, that Janus faced that light side, that dark side, kind of both combined in this one corporate giant.
Yeah, it's a great story. I lived through a lot of what you wrote about, either as a reporter or dealing with these things in my own businesses, and really appreciate the way you stitched it all together. You think you did a great job. The book Samsung Rising, it's available on Amazon. Where else can we find you, Jeffrey?
So I'm on Twitter. It's @Jeffrey_Kane. I'm also on Instagram, GeoKane. And you can also buy the book on my personal website, so jeffreykane.net or Barnes and Noble, all these big bookstores, they all have it.
All right, it's a great read. I'm glad you put it together. And when you do another book, certainly let us know. I want to be part of that.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Well, I hope you guys really enjoyed that interview. I had a great time with Jeffrey and could have kept going. I know he's working on another project, so we will definitely have him back. Make sure to check out our subreddit. Hit us at info@storagereview to catch up and chat on anything you like. And check us out on YouTube and Instagram and all those other great places. Thanks again for tuning in. Bye-bye.